But then what's beautiful about this kind of garden, as opposed to an annual vegetable garden, is it assumes a life of its own around the third or fourth year. And then you get to watch how nature decides things are going to evolve. And, you know, my adage is, if I like it, I leave it. If I don't like it, I weed it.
In this episode of Voices from the Field, NCAT Sustainable Agriculture Specialist Gabriela Soto-Velez talks with author and farmer Danny Baker. Since her retirement from another career and subsequent inspiration from an extension class on permaculture, Danny has become well known for her takes on creating resilient, edible landscapes. She and Gabriela discuss the benefits that come from realizing that nature knows what it is doing. Let's listen.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to ATRA Voices from the Field podcast. My name is Gabriela Soto-Velez, and I'm a sustainable agricultural specialist at NCAT. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing Danny Baker. She is the author of The Homescale Forest Garden, How to Plan, Plant, and Tend a Resilient Edible Landscape. I just wanted to thank you so much for your time and thank you for being here. I would love if you could introduce yourself and maybe give a little bit of a background of how this book came to fruition, and then we can dive a little bit deeper into your background.
Okay, so we're entering our 19th season of our highly diversified organic farm on Wellesley Island, which is in the middle of the St. Lawrence River, very far north in New York State. This is a retirement gig for me. My career was as a psychologist, and as I was nearing retirement, I was really worried about what I was going to do with all my idle time. So we bought this 100-acre plot that was an abandoned dairy farm. And we started to farm, we started with a vegetable garden. And that solved my problem of what I was going to do with my idle time, because when you're a farmer, you don't have any. So that's pretty much my background and how we got started here.
Did you have any experience with gardening before you started, or did you just jump right in?
As a child, I did a lot of landscaping because my parents bought a newly built house on what had been a cornfield. It was half an acre and there were no trees, no gardens, nothing. And I was the oldest and strongest of the family. So I got to pitchfork all over the sod for all of the flower beds in the vegetable garden and dig all the holes for trees and then take care of it all until we moved when I was 13. So from around 7 to 13, it was so much fun to do, to be outdoors and working with the dirt. So I loved it. And that passion kind of was not exercised until I retired, and then I could do it again.
Thank you for sharing that. So I know that you have the Cross Island Farms, and that is like your property, but also you have the Enchanted Edible Forest. I was wondering if maybe you could give me an overview of what is the edible forest and what are some of the principles that all of this is founded on?
Sure. So I got inspired to do this planting 11 years ago, or maybe it was 12 now, when I took a 2-hour class from a professor from Cornell, who came up to our local cooperative extension office and gave a talk on, quote, permaculture, 2-hour talk. I had never even heard the word before, but the concepts made so much sense to me that I decided there and then I was going to plant an edible forest. So basically what it is, it's a planting of perennial food plants that's modeled after a forest edge. So if you think about a forest edge or a cut in the road where there's woods and there's tall trees, short trees, bushes, herbaceous undergrowth, ground cover, and even vines curling up where there's lots of sun, that's kind of what you're modeling after. You want to use all the vertical space, and there are many virtues to that. You want to absorb all the solar radiation you can. You want to keep the ground covered at all times and shaded so that the moisture is preserved in the ground. You want to collect dew in an arid area. The nights get cold often, like in the desert. A lot of dew gets deposited on leaves. And the more leaves you have, the more vertical space you use, the more canopy you have, the more dew is collected and absorbed by the leaves and also drops to the ground, is absorbed by the ground. So you want to conserve water. You want to build in all the nutrients that your food producing plants need through other plants. So most of you are probably aware of nitrogen fixing plants that have nodules on their roots that contain bacteria that convert the nitrogen in the air into forms, chemical forms that the plants can use. You want to interplant those at all levels so that the nitrogen for the other plants will be provided. You want to provide other kinds of plants called nutrient accumulators that pull up other nutrients from deep in the subsoil, which a lot of fruit trees, for example, and berry bushes, many of them don't have very deep roots. So unless there's some provision for those nutrients like phosphorus, potassium, calcium, and the micronutrients, they're going to be starved for the nutrients they need unless you add amendments. And the whole idea of the forest garden is minimizing human labor going forward. So you don't want to be always adding amendments, fertilizers, and you don't want to be spraying. So that's another thing. You build in pest protection through integrating lots of herbs that might confuse pests, odorous things like herbs and alliums, and also bringing in the native wildlife to deal with pests. So you have your beneficial insects that kill pests, you have birds, you have amphibians and reptiles. You want to invite all of those things, even foxes and skunks, into your garden because they do a lot of service and they're fertilizing at the same time. That was a long-winded answer, but...
No, it was perfect. You pretty much covered like the whole book there. And, you know, having foxes, skunks, and all types of critters in a garden does sound pretty enchanting, to be honest. So I wanted to talk about some of the key points that you put in your book. It was so beautiful. So I'm really happy I got to take a look at that. But you talk about one of these concepts called hugelkultur, and that's maybe for like a more humid or wet area. So I would love if you could expand upon that because I've never heard that term before.
Oh, great. Well, a hugelkultur mound is something that you build starting with wood. So they could be branches, they could be logs, which you pack closely together at the base. And that forms the basic form of your mound. And you can make them any size. They can be, I have some 50 foot long ones. I have some that are like just 6 feet. And then on top of that, you pile all kinds of organic matter. Now, some people say it has to be certain kinds and certain order. I don't agree with that. Anything you've got. So garden waste, like, you know, pumpkin vines that are left over at the end of the season. I've gone across the road where I have a swamp and cut reeds and thrown them on, cattails, grass, compost, if you have it, soil, any extra soil you have, anything like that. Leaves are great, tree leaves, just pile it on. You want to make, that's going to sink down with gravity. So you want to put plenty on top so that when it decays, there'll be at least 6 inches of soil above the logs that you have at the bottom. And then I always cover it with some wood chips that hold down the leaves and also are a seedless. You don't want, the top layer should not have any weed seeds in it. So a couple of inches of wood chips just to keep weeds from growing and to hold in whatever else is there. And the beauty of this is you can bring a planting area up above a ground that has a high water table or even standing water. I have some woods that have standing water for a good part of the year, and I built these in there, and I have stuff growing even though there's water 6 inches deep at the base. It also, if you have woods where you want to grow things, and a lot of things, actually food-bearing plants will grow in partial or even moderate shade, you can build these in the woods and you get away from any root competition from the standing woods. Also, if you have stony soil or if you have rock, you can build these on top of that. And it gives you a nice cushion of soil above what might not be ground that you can really grow anything in. So many virtues. Now, in addition to that construction description, the wood at the base actually acts as a water sink. So as that wood rots and provides organic matter also for the mound, it absorbs water that comes into the mound, but also actually pulls it up from the ground. So in a drought period, the roots of the plants you put on top of the mound can get down there and get water from that rotting wood. That's another virtue. It also provides a whole lot of different microclimates. So if you think of a mound, you emphasize your south-facing slope, your north-facing slope. The top will be better drained, it'll be drier. Around the base will be moister. So you have all these little microclimates that you create when you build a mound like this. There's other virtues too. I'll stop there.
I bet you could probably grow some mushrooms on there as well from the logs too. So that could be another output that would be interesting for possibly people with the right climate. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So it's essentially almost like a raised compost bed that you could grow things into, but it's completely natural. The whole thing is for planting in.
Right. And the nice thing is it doesn't cost you anything except your labor, because you don't need to import wood for like sides of a raised bed and soil. It's all you, if you have, you, most people have this on any size of property, you have all of this stuff already, or you can have your power company every 7 years when they clear the lines, have them drop the chips at your place rather than take them to the dump.
I was wondering how many years or seasons could you use, or have you used your hugelkultur beds?
You know, that's a good question. They will tend to sink down over time, but I started my first ones 11 years ago. And even though they've sunk down, everything's still growing on top of them. Mm-hmm. So.
And you can add to them probably every season as well.
You can add height if you want to. Yeah. I occasionally will throw some, you know, 3 or 4 inches of additional wood chips on top to just get it back up. Yep.
Okay. That's awesome. So I know that you started with just essentially it was a cattle farm, and then there was a lot of wooded area on your property. It's about 100 acres from what I've read. I was wondering if you could go into how to pick your site. So maybe you could go into a little bit of the permaculture aspect mm-hmm. of a site description mm-hmm. for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the beauty of permaculture is you can grow on just about any site. So, you know, in my case, my partner had put a perimeter fence around his pasture, and he didn't want to give up any of that. So he found a half acre that wasn't inside the perimeter fence, and he fenced it off for me to begin my garden. It wasn't something I chose, but it turned out to be really useful, because there are all these, there's little, all kinds of different slopes and microclimates. There's some really low wet areas. There's a south-facing slope that's higher and drier. So the diversity of landscape really enabled me to plant a whole big diversity of plants, which if it was a more uniform plot, I might not have been able to do as much with that. You know, you want to put it in an area that you're going to visit fairly frequently. You don't want it way in the back 40 because it doesn't need as much attention as an annual market garden, for example, where you're in there every single day. But it does need to be accessible. Yeah, so it doesn't have to be right outside your front door. Mine is actually an eighth of a mile down the road, and it's a nice, very pleasant walk to go back and forth. So I see that as a plus, that I'm getting some exercise going back and forth. I don't mean to disagree with the premise of your question, but I mean, if you are going to grow fruit trees, if that's going to be your primary planting and that you want to get most of your product from, you definitely want to find a well-drained area, because fruit trees need good drainage. Okay. I didn't necessarily have that. I had heavy clay. So I built those 50-foot long hugelkultur mounds to raise the soil, improve the drainage, loosen it up so that my fruit trees might thrive better than in the heavy clay. But it doesn't matter what you've got. You can find plants like Asian pears. I found don't mind the heavy clay, and that's a wonderful crop to grow. So whatever your land is, you can find a way to match your plants to their ideal habitats and have a very productive garden.
Thanks for clarifying. I think that's actually a really important point, because so often when people are looking to start some type of garden or forest garden, you know, you're so preoccupied with getting the right, you know, solar aspect and topography. And oftentimes you just don't have that luxury of having everything perfect. So, you know, the way you speak about, I got what I got and now I have to work with it. So I'm building these hugelkultur beds and, you know, using these different topographies and biomes, for instance, to my benefit to have a wider array of biodiversity, mm-hmm. I think is a really good point, which makes things a little bit easier in regards to starting your garden for sure.
So what I didn't really emphasize before is the importance of knowing the ideal habitats of your plants and matching them with their ideal habitat in your plot. And the importance of this is that, first of all, it minimizes human labor, because if you put a plant that likes really good drainage, you know, on a well-drained slope, it's going to be happy. there's not going to be much you're going to have to do. If you put it on a soggy, saturated place, it's going to be sick. It's going to attract disease and pests, and you're probably going to have to move it if you want it to survive. So it's going to need a lot of attention, and then you're going to have to dig it up and put it somewhere else. So matching your plants with their ideal habitats and understanding what your plants need to be happy is the first step. And then as you're designing your garden, you just take that plant that likes partial shade, wet ground, and you put it in your partially shaded wet area. You take the plant that likes full sun and good drainage in that part of your plot, and your work is reduced down the road tremendously by doing that.
Learn how to harvest the sun twice with practical information at NCATS AgriSolar Clearinghouse. Get access to more than 400 peer-reviewed articles, the latest in AgriSolar news, and connect with farmers and solar developers who are working together to make the most out of our shared resources. We'll see you at agrisolarclearinghouse.org.
So that's kind of a good topic to piggyback off for my next question, which is, what are some of the challenges that you've had or some of the big lessons that you've learned since this was your first go around with, farming essentially or gardening? What are some of the things that you've learned or struggled with that other people might benefit from?
Well, that's a really good question. I like that question. First thing I think of is I've learned how resilient these perennial plants are. So at first, if something looked dead, I just dug it up and plan to put something else there. Well, half the time the roots were still alive. And if I had, been more patient, that's another thing, patience. If I'd been more patient and just observed a little longer, I would have seen that maybe the top branches were dead, but above the graft or above the ground, whatever, was still alive. And I could have cut it back to there and it would have been, very happy. So that's one thing I learned. Mistakes I made early on was prematurely assuming something was dead when it really wasn't, and how resilient these plants are. Mistakes I've made, managing pests is very challenging. I didn't do this at first. When I saw a caterpillar nest on a tree, I thought, oh, I have to get rid of that right away. Otherwise, it's going to defoliate the entire tree. And then I visited this permaculture orchard called Miracle Farm in southern Quebec in Canada. And the man who owns this, he has birdhouses everywhere. He must have literally hundreds of birdhouses in his 5-acre plot. And I took a tour with him and he said, when he sees a caterpillar nest on a tree, he doesn't do anything. The birds come, they eat the caterpillars and they never move to another branch. And I thought, wow, that makes so much sense. I'm going to put some birdhouses in. And now when I see a caterpillar nest, I don't do anything. And within a few days, the birds have come and eaten those caterpillars. And if they come back because they didn't get them all, they come again a few days later and they take care of it. And the other thing is the important point here is not only are they taking care of your pests, but you're feeding them. If you get rid of that nest, you're destroying their food, which is what pesticides do. That's why all the songbirds are dying, because they have nothing to eat. Bringing in nature has been a really good lesson of mine. And the more I accept, the more I just observe and appreciate that nature knows what she's doing, the less obsessive I've become about weeding and, manicuring and all this. In fact, I got to tell you the story. So we had about an 8-week drought of a couple of summers ago, and I was so busy with other things that I didn't weed. And when I decided to do a little weed whacking, I just did a 3-foot square area. I noticed that 2 days later, it all turned brown. And I said, I'm not doing this. I'm going to kill everything because it's too dry. I let everything grow. There was the biggest crop of leopard frogs that year living at the base of all this herbaceous growth that was holding in the moisture in the ground and also collecting all the dew at night. It was so moist under there, they were probably eating mosquitoes that were breeding down low, which I never saw because it all happened under this 2 feet of herbaceous growth. So I've just, come to really accept that nature knows what she's doing, and it's just really fun to watch what she's going to do. And that brings us to that whole idea of succession that you had a question about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really beautiful. Instead of adding inputs, you're actually just increasing the natural spaces, which naturally increases the biodiversity and then it takes care of itself. Mm-hmm. So that's a really beautiful principle that I think a lot of farmers could actually benefit from, reducing your labor and your cost inputs by just letting nature do its thing. Obviously, it depends on what you're producing for, but I think that on any scale, that's a really valuable principle. So yeah, of course, so speaking of succession planting, I would love to know your take on how to incorporate succession planting or the value in regards to the forest garden. And maybe while you're at it, you could touch upon the benefits that you've seen of the perennials and the impact that it can have in regards to the soil health, biodiversity, and the overall ecosystem health.
So the beauty about this perennial planting is you plant it once. And then after you plant it, the ground remains undisturbed. So to answer the last part of your question, that encourages all the soil life, the fungal life, and all of the beneficial creatures that live under the soil to just reproduce and really have, you know, a very productive life. And of course, when the leaves fall, remember, you're using all these layers. The mulch, all that mulch that's naturally created is going to feed those critters, and you're just keep on improving the soil through the fact that you're not disturbing it and all of the natural things that happen, all of the critters that are fertilizing it, all of the natural foliage that's falling when the herbaceous, those tall herbaceous plants died down, they provided more organic matter for the soil. So all of that is very positive. Now, succession. So in natural succession, you start with annuals, you go to perennial herbaceous plants, then brush starts up. Then the trees actually come up inside the brush because they're sheltered, and that's where the birds are laying or are pooping with the tree seeds in their poop. So that's, you know, the trees grow up, and then eventually you have a woods. You know, the woods, you'll get a hard, you know, you'll get soft wood, then you'll get hard wood. That'll shade out the brush. So you really, in this kind of garden, you're actually creating the succession all at once. So you're building your tall trees, your bushes, your herbaceous matter, your ground covers, your vines. You're putting all that in essentially at the same time. Maybe it'll take 2 or 3 years, but much quicker than it would happen in nature. But then what's beautiful about this kind of garden, as opposed to an annual vegetable garden, is it assumes a life of its own around the third or fourth year. And then you get to watch how nature decides things are going to evolve. And, you know, my adage is, if I like it, I leave it. If I don't like it, I weed it. So more and more I'm liking things and I'm just letting them go. And, you know, it's funny because if you're just observing and you're seeing what nature wants to do, it doesn't stay the same. So, for example, I had one row of fruit trees where I didn't do any ground cover at first because I just didn't have time. So the first thing that grew up were thistles. Okay, well, you know, the seeds feed the birds and everything. And I didn't have time to deal with it. The second year there were thistles, but the third year there was milkweed. The thistles had disappeared. Now there's milkweed. Well, that's even better. Not only is every part of that plant edible for people, but it's feeding the birds, it's feeding the butterflies. So I just really enjoy seeing even the herbaceous growth. It evolves. It doesn't, it's not stationary. And that's, it's just really interesting to watch. And I feel that nature knows there's a reason why certain plants are where they are when they are. They're doing a service to actually increase the quality of the soil and increase, as you've mentioned, the diversity as well. The other thing about perennials, which I really value when you have a diverse planting that like the one I have, is if you have a year like last spring, we had 4 frosts in May. The last one was May 28th. A lot of the fruit trees lost their blossoms. I had no cherries, only half of my pears, only half of my plums or less had fruit. But my Asian pears are fine. My beach plums had a bumper crop. My honeyberries were really fine because they're impervious to that. They're very early. They have fruit in June where I am. First year ever, we had a very dry spring, which was very unusual for us. I've had June berries in my garden for 10 years. It's the first year I ever had fruit because they hate the clay soil. But this year it was dry. So they, they didn't develop fungal disease. So I don't know, I'm going on and on, but it's very rewarding to have this kind of planting. It's just so interesting to observe and experience.
Well, it's kind of like the aspect of the title of your book, the resiliency of the landscape. So if one thing doesn't work out, you have a myriad of other crops or plants to choose from. And then as well, touching on the aspect of the benefits of perennials, you know, there's so many health benefits in perennial crops, like even just something as simple as dandelion, and people don't even realize it. They see it as a weed, but it has so many benefits for our health. And, you know, I was watching your WPBS teaser, which we'll get to at the end of this podcast, but it was really cool watching you make, you know, the different like salads from so many of the perennial crops that I've never heard of. And you were speaking about, you know, the more bitter, actually the better, because it has different benefits for our health. So in line with that, I would love to know, what are some of the favorite perennial greens that you've discovered, or some other crops that you haven't heard of before that you started using in your garden, then you're just like, wow, this is so great?
Well, you know, I want your audience to know that I'd never heard or seen of 95% of the plants I ended up planting in this garden. So, I mean, it was just such an adventure to learn about these things. And if I thought I could grow it, I bought it. You know, that was it. But as far as the greens go, there's something called Good King Henry, which is a perennial green that is a little bit like spinach. The beauty of it is you plant it once. It's been coming up now for 10 years. Plus, these perennials, they can deal with competition. Like most annual plants have been bred so that you need a clean bed. You know, you can't have weeds growing, too much competition. These guys will grow amidst all kinds of other ground cover and herbaceous plants, and they're happy. So that's one. It's like a spinach. You can eat it raw. You can cook it. There's another one called Turkish Rocket, which is another perennial. Every part of the plant is edible. The leaves early, the flowers are edible. Then the flower buds are like a broccolia. It's in that family. It's in the crucifer family. The flowers are edible. And the other thing about these plants is, about the perennials, is you basically have an harvest if you have a diverse planting from, in my area, which is zone 5 now, from March right through into November. So you have a huge season of harvest. Yeah, so those are a couple of the perennial greens that I really like. There's lots of perennial flowers that I never knew existed that I enjoy putting in a salad as well in season. Even violet leaves are yummy, you know, as part of a mix, a salad mix. A lot of the herbs give a little bit of tang to the salad, like lemon balm, a little bit of lemon balm, a little bit of sorrel here, there, you know, a little bit of this and that. There's a wonderful herb called sweet Sicily that has an anise flavor, and the leaves are shaped like a fern. It's not a fern, but you can eat the leaves. The seeds are like big fennel seeds. They're also delicious. So, and then of course, a lot of the berries that I'd never heard of, some of the native berries like aronia, and clove currant and honeyberries are some of my favorites, and they're even native plants. I'm not exclusively native in my planting. I have a lot of natives mixed in there, but I also have some exotics like Asian pears that I wouldn't want to do without. And I find that as far as the pollinators go, some of them are generalists, like bumblebees. They'll take pollen and nectar out of just about anything. And then as long as you have a bunch of natives in your planting, your native pollinators and other bugs that are specialists will have what they need also. So that's my philosophy about that.
Thank you for sharing. I need to get up to your farm and try one of these salads. I'm hungry now.
You're too sweet.
But I wanted to ask, because, you know, people are going to be thinking, where do my annuals go? Do I even get to grow vegetables in this type of forest garden? How do I get tomatoes? I know that's a fun section that you put in your book. So would you mind just touching on that?
Sure. Well, most annual vegetables need full sun. So if you design a section of your garden which is in full sun, and have just a traditional garden. You can do that. You can integrate it, or you can build a couple of hugel culture mounds that you put your annual vegetables on. You might be able to scatter some seeds in your other plantings, like maybe some chard, lettuce, radishes that can take a little bit of shade and, you know, would be happy growing up amongst your other plants. That's another option. I have, my vegetable garden is very close to the house, so that's where I grow most of my annuals. But I have grown annuals on my hugelkultur mounds the first year just to get roots in the ground. And to so it gives me a little time to plan what I'm going to put there that's more permanent.
Thank you. So this, what started off as just like an experiment for your retirement, actually has turned into a business now. Not only do you have your book, but you also do a U-Pick farm as well. Is that correct?
Yes. So I have U-Pick in the edible forest, not so much with the vegetables. I've actually cut back on my vegetables considerably the last couple of years. So I have plenty to supply my retail venues, but I kind of stopped trying to hustle wholesale, because I wanted to have more time to spend enjoying the edible forest and, you know, keeping it looking nice, because I'm having more tours and more talks. So I want it to look nice all the time.
Well, that's exciting. I'm happy that it evolved in a nice way for you. So in addition to your book, The Home Scale Forest Garden, you have some other cool things that are coming up, and I got to see a little sneak peek of it. So do you want to go ahead and maybe talk about your WPPS show that's coming out?
I'd love to. So the working title is The Home Scale Forest Garden Show. And basically, I pitched this to them, and they decided to start with 6 episodes. So we actually had our first shoot a week ago in, you know, late winter chores, right? Because that's part of it. So basically, we're going to go through the entire year and show the different chores that, you know, I do to maintain the garden over the course of the season. Plus, you know, what's blooming, what's ready to pick, what kind of recipes might be appropriate for this, that, or the other thing. And also in the course of this 6 episodes, give an overview, like we talked about earlier, of what a forest garden is and how to assess your land and design your own garden. So all of that's in it. So like even for this first shoot, I pruned some bushes. I did some frost seeding. I took some cuttings and showed how you plant the cuttings to make new plants. I did some seeding of perennial vegetables that'll grow and then I can transplant out. And I also cooked some, I actually showed people how to cook some sunchokes, some Jerusalem artichokes, because I was harvesting them in March as well. So it was, you know, a lot of different aspects to show late winter. And we'll go on with, you know, a little later in the like mid spring and then early summer, mid summer, late summer, fall. So that's 6.
Well, that's cool. It's kind of like a farm to table series in a way, with all of the practical agriculture bits in between. When is it airing? Do you have an idea of the first airing?
They hope a year from now that it's going to be nationally distributed. So if you want your local station to pick it up, talk to the people there when it's ready to come out. I think around a year from now in the spring is when it'll be ready. We have our first national sponsor, which is, what is it? Reed's Ginger Ale and Ginger Beer. Yep. So that's pretty exciting. And it's just, I'm excited because I want to share this information with as many people as possible. I just think it's the way to go. It's so ecologically sound. It's so productive. It's so rewarding for the gardener. Your labor is minimized compared to annual vegetables. I mean, there's lots of labor involved. Don't get me wrong. It's not like you can just sit back and relax and not do anything, but it's much slower paced. It's more enjoyable. It's spaced throughout the entire year. Right now, like this morning, I did some pruning for a couple of hours, got some sun. I'm getting tan.
Looking good, Danny. Well, thank you so much for your time. I hope that everybody gets the opportunity to read your book. And it was just so nice meeting you. I actually met you at the Virginia Association for Biological Farming Conference in January. And this is how all of this started. And I'm just really happy that we could make it come to fruition. It was a pleasure speaking with you. Your book is beautiful. I saw the first teaser of your WPPS series, and it was very cool and informative. So I just wanted to thank you again for your time, and it was really beautiful speaking with you this morning.
Well, I feel the same. Thank you so much. And my book, by the way, is available on all the online venues for anyone who'd like to purchase it. If you come to the farm, you can buy one from me and I'll sign it.
Absolutely. I'm going to actually link your website, the links for your book and all of that in the show notes of the podcast. Everybody can find your information very easily. Wonderful. But thanks again. I hope that this was valuable for people. I think it definitely was. And I look forward to speaking with you again and seeing how your series evolves.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.